Welcome to Conversations with Leaders on Tremendous Life Radio, providing some of today's most influential and inspiring leaders a platform to share their stories of growing up, what happened, and what they're doing today. Now, here's your host, Todd Weaver.
Thanks a lot, Melody, for being on the show, first of all.
My pleasure, Todd.
I understand there's a lot of wind out there.
Yeah, I'm glad we were able to connect. The winds are blowing. The Santa Anas, they're a different kind of a wind. They carry a strange energy with them, and they bring changes, and they can be kind of spooky in a way.
Well, I'm glad we connected, and I hope we stay on the air. We're going to let this go, and we're just going
to
let it all play out.
Sounds good to me.
Let's start right away, right from the beginning. Just, if you would, tell us about your growing up and your young days.
My growing up didn't really start until I was about 25. But, you know, if you would have asked me 10 years ago how much of codependency was about grief, I would have said, oh, maybe 10%. And now if you ask me how much of codependency was about grief, I would say all of it. Every single bit of it. I believe now that we find coping mechanisms as children to deal with pain that's too much. You know, we just don't have the skills or resources to deal with it. And we're in deep grief. We're in deep grief because we have a parent abusing us, because we live in a crazy home. And so we start doing these things to take care of ourselves the best we can. And we're stuck in grief. And these behaviors have come to be known as codependency, and they become habitual behaviors, and that's what happened to me. I lived in a family. I was abducted off the streets when I was 4 years old. The police found me, but it was never talked about again. I can see now where a lot of the things my mother did were to protect me and her own fears after that, but as a child, all it meant to me was I was deprived. I couldn't go to movies, I couldn't go roller skating, I couldn't go anywhere. I had to stay home all the time. I think as a parent, I can see where my mother would have been afraid that this would happen again, but as a child, it felt horrible to me. I had a stream of stepfathers that were real jerks, most of them. But that was the past.
Right.
The problem is, unless we deal with the emotions of the past, we keep recreating it, which is what I did. My mom made it clear every day that she wishes she would have aborted me when she could have. And so then I developed the belief that I didn't belong here. I didn't deserve to live. And the problem is, when I left home at age 18, I took all those beliefs with me. And I had started drinking when I was 12 years old. By the time I was 13, I was an alcoholic. And I mean, I was having blackouts. I was still a straight-A student in a private academy. But there was something wrong. And it was in the old days before we knew that kids could be alcoholics. And so nobody knew what to do with me. I didn't know what to do with myself. I thought there was something fundamentally wrong with me. And I turned to drugs. At age 18, I could see that alcohol was destroying me. And so I made the only reasonable decision I was capable of making, and that's I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm only going to do drugs. And that was in the days when drugs were hard to find. And so I had to really search out drugs. I had to go to, like, the bad section of town. Here's this little girl that's gone to this real strict conservative Christian academy, showing up at an after-hours joint, sitting all prim and proper, and approaching this man 25 years my senior and saying, "Hi, it's a pleasure to meet you. I've heard I can get drugs from you." And he said, "You know, you've got to be kidding me. Yeah. Who is this person?" Well, you know, when there's a will, there's a way, and I had a will, and it didn't take long for me to get involved in the drug world. And I lived in Minnesota then. You can't use street drugs because by the time they get there, they've been cut too much. So there's an old thing called the Minnesota Mafia, and it would start with the group that robbed drugstores, and then it would go down to the art students who would take the leftovers from the drugstore robberies. I mean, they'd take birth control pills that they thought they could get high from them. Well, I found a drugstore robber to hang out with. You know, I went right to the source.
Sure.
And so I had a good run. And thank God I was arrested, because if I hadn't been, I would have killed myself.
Hmm.
I went to treatment. A judge finally, instead of saying, "What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this," said, "I don't care where you went to school. I don't care what kind of grades you got. I don't care how many people you have here in court with you. Do you know you're responsible for your own behavior?" And his question really threw me, because the answer was no, I didn't know that. I thought if we didn't get what we wanted, if bad things happened to me, if I got an unfair hand dealt to me, that I could do whatever I wanted, which I could, but I also got the consequences
right.
for my behavior. So he told me I could either go to prison for 5 years, or I could go to treatment for as long as it took. And he wasn't kidding. I was in, and this wasn't luxurious treatment. It was a state hospital that had a few cottages devoted to chemical dependency treatment. And I was there for 8 months. It was a six-week program. And that's one of the problems I have with treatment today, Todd, is that, you know, it took me 3 months before I even stopped using drugs in treatment.
Yeah.
And we have treatment that lasts 2 weeks or 1 month. That's not enough time.
Yeah.
It's just not enough time. Well, I had a spiritual awakening. Instead of having it come later on in my journey to wellness, it came at the very beginning. And I was out on a lawn smoking a joint at treatment. And I had just been scared out of my mind, because I had, a couple days earlier, I had copped some speed. Only I had gotten it the night before my probation officer was coming to visit. Well, as a sign of a true alcoholic, I had put the drugs in my closet in my room, and they started calling my name, and so I thought, well, I'll take just one. And then I thought, well, you know, why take just one? That's, you know, that's like throwing it away. I might as well take two. And before the night ended, I had taken all of the speed. I was laying there, It really scared me. For the first time, I was scared. I realized that my behavior was going to land me in jail if I didn't stop. And I realized I couldn't stop on my own.
Right.
And that was very depressing. And I didn't know it at the time. It was also the miracle I needed for change, realizing I couldn't stop on my own. So I looked up, I came home in the hospital, in the state hospital, and I looked up at the ceiling and I said, God, I don't know if you're there and if you care, but if you are and you do, and if there's a way I can get clean and sober, please help me do it. Nothing happened. And so I thought, well, you know, there's that. But 3 days later, I was sitting on the lawn. I was smoking some marijuana. I had gotten, was able to get a joint. Marijuana was never my drug of choice, but a true addict will take anything they can get their hands on. And I was truly an addict. And I took a hit out the joint, laid back, and it was like the whole world turned purple. And I could see my connection to God, to the universe. It's hard to describe a spiritual awakening because it transcends words. But I knew that I had no right to continue doing to my body what I had been doing. And I also realized that if I put half as much energy into doing the right thing as I had put into doing the wrong thing, that there was very little I couldn't do. And so I ran back into the treatment center, and I took all the energy I had been throwing into being a bad person and put it into doing the right thing. And my life turned around 180 degrees. And now it might seem like that was an overnight transformation, but I really believe that change starts like 2 years before it happens. You know, there's signs, there's preparation, things happen within us. And that was just the moment when things really shifted and turned for me. To me, that's the definition of being born again. Because I was a new human being. And also, it wasn't a matter of getting rid of the old Melody. It was taking all of my character defects and using the positive or the flip side of them, like turning obsession into passion, turning obsession into persistence for getting the job done. I was reading an article in the New York Times recently, and it said that children who come from really dysfunctional or abusive homes really are the winners out there in the work world. Because when other people fold, when other people fail, the codependent will step up to the plate. They will get the job done. They can handle high-stress situations, and they won't give up.
Yeah.
And so, to me, a lot of recovery is taking my character defects and using the positive side of them, or using them for good.
Now, Melody, when you're talking about these things, you didn't really realize that day on the lawn, the moment you were on the lawn, that that was probably one of the most empowering moments of your life. I mean, this is all from staying alive.
I don't think we ever know when we're experiencing a thing how important it is. It takes retrospect to give it clarity and to truly understand. To me, it was one more moment in time, and I couldn't tell anyone about it. I was already in a state hospital. If I went in there and say, "Hey, the world just turned purple. I saw God," you know, I'd never get out.
Right.
So I didn't tell anyone about it. I didn't realize that for the next 20 years I'd be, you know, talking about that incident. And I didn't realize the impact it would have on my life. I think that's why it's so important for me and for other people to be grateful for everything that happens in our life today, because we don't understand how it's going to work out in the overall picture.
Yeah.
We don't understand what it is yet. And I think it's good, because if we did understand what it was, we'd try and control everything and we'd mess it up.
Yeah.
So it's on my blog. The name of my blog is Living in the Mystery, and it's something that has taken me a long time to learn to do, and that means I trust what I don't know more than I trust what I do know. And it also means living by faith, not hope. Hope means I hope tomorrow is going to be better. Faith to me says I'm right where I need to be today.
That's great information.
That's a hard one,
yeah.
Especially now when the world, I'm going through, you know, some personal difficulties right now with an employee that got confused about whose money mine was. She was charged with 10 felony counts of theft by swindling from me, and I haven't given permission to talk about this. So she has been charged with allegedly stealing over $400,000 from me. This has taken up my entire year. I'm still working on the financial paperwork, and so trusting that this is where I am supposed to be. It's not a matter of I learned these things a long time ago and I'm fine now.
Yeah.
It's a matter of we are given tools to carry around in our toolbox, because we're going to need to use them. And I'm still using the things I learned back in the beginning, letting go, trusting, having faith that I am where I need to be today, talking about feelings, talking about emotions, letting myself be who I am, moving out of resistance, and trying not to stay in denial too long about things.
It takes a lot of conscious effort for me, and I think for others too, to do that, to discipline ourselves to do those things all the time. I'm probably never as grateful as I should be all the time.
I believe that a lot of us lived in a negative environment so long that that negativity and depression are habitual.
Yeah.
And it does take conscious, focused effort for me to be grateful. I mean, we can read in the paper about people in other and third world countries, people that don't have enough food to eat, people that go to bed every night hungry, people that would give anything to have the lives we have, and it still doesn't click. Hey, why aren't I grateful?
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't I grateful? I've been given a life that people would kill to have, and most of us in the United States have. I've been given the gift of free choice, free will. I'm not going to get stoned to death if I divorce my husband.
Right.
You know, yes, it's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to be painful. It's going to hurt. But at least I can make these choices. We're very blessed. We're very, very fortunate in this country. We just don't know it yet. And it might take a long time before we do.
Okay, Melody, you're talking about your kind of, you didn't really describe the bottom. You described the yard incident when smoking some pot. I mean, I'm curious moving forward, did you always have a dream in your heart to write, or where did that come about?
I always wanted to be a writer. When I was 5 or 6 years old, when they ask you to write about what you want to be when you grow up, I wanted to write. That dream started to get squelched the first time in school. I wrote a story about what was going on in my family.
Yeah.
And my mother found that story, and she went ballistic. And I was told, never to write about the family again. Well, little did I know I'd be making my living doing that someday. Little did my mother know that. But I went, my bottom, I had a very low bottom. And again, this was in the old days. I don't know if people can even relate to that. It was before the three strikes law, thank God. It was before AIDS, thank God. But I went all the way down to shooting drugstore drugs and doing drugstore robberies with my boyfriend, the whole Bonnie and Clyde thing. And actually, when I got arrested at the end, I had so many scar tracks on my arms, scars from shooting drugs, that the state of Minnesota asked if they could use pictures of my arms in their drug prevention program. It was interesting to me because I'm an honorary member of the board of directors of Eden House, and that's a diversionary drug treatment program in Minnesota. And we were having a board of directors meeting, and everyone stood up when I entered the room, and they were honored to meet me and, shook my hands. And some people asked me if I could autograph their book. And I was just reflecting, thinking, 35 years ago, the only reason these people would have been in the room with me is if they were arresting me and sending me to jail. And now they're standing up.
Yeah, that's...
It's so important when we look at people to not see the things that we want to see right away, but to see that there's a real human being there. That could be anything. And to treat people with respect, to respect the God part in every human being, because we never know.
Yeah.
We never know. I still think that's funny. When people do all this kowtowing to me, thinking, 35 years ago, they wouldn't have wanted anything to do with me. It's just so important to treat everyone with kindness and love and respect that we meet throughout life, whether it's a drunk we encounter on the street or the president of a country.
That, again, is good information. It sounds great in theory, but practicing and disciplining ourselves to do that is a different kind of, that's a whole different story.
Well, consciousness is its own punishment, in my most recent book, Making Miracles in 40 Days, and I'm not here just to promote my work, but my books reveal who I am or what I have to say. I talk about a simple exercise that people can do 10 minutes a day to help improve consciousness, and I talk about it because it's what helps me. A lot of people think, I don't approach my books from I'm an expert and here's how you should do it. I approach my books from this is what I'm working on. This is what I'm trying to do because it's helping me. This is what I need to keep remembering to do every day because it makes my life better when I do that. And I think that's so much of what changing our lives is about. I don't know that we're ever going to be free from a time when we have, hard things going on in our lives as well as good things. It's usually a balance, and sometimes it leans more to one side than the other. But it's about practicing these behaviors in all areas of our life, finances, friendships, romantic relationships, at work, all areas, because that's where we take ourselves. That's like the dojo of our lives, and we never know what we're learning. usually we think we're learning something other than what we're really learning, because again, like I said, we'd mess it up if we knew what it was we were supposed to be learning. So it goes back to letting go of what we think is going on, surrendering, and being willing to live in the mystery, being willing to live with what we don't know and don't understand yet, and may never understand.
Yeah, it's interesting.
That it's the right thing.
It's just interesting that everything's inside out, or it becomes that way, or it seems that way, you know, and that's the opposite of what I think most of the time. You know, if I get a good idea, do the opposite, things like that. Those are hard things to practice.
Yeah. I remember once I kept trying to get out of this relationship. That it wasn't a good relationship. I didn't want to be in it. And the more I try and avoid the person, the more I get sucked back into it. And a friend of mine said, Melody, do you remember those Chinese finger cuffs? And they're those little straw things, and you put your fingers in them, and if you try and get out and pull hard, the harder you pull to try and get out, the more stuck you become. You have to relax and let go in order to be set free. And life is pretty much the same way. The more we resist it, the more we fight it, the more stuck we get where we are. It's by relaxing and letting go that we set ourselves free.
And that's what makes it so difficult. And not difficult that it can't be done or with hope, but a lot of practice and a lot of discipline. I guess understanding that, or at least getting a peek at that, is a good place to start. But typically we have to beat ourselves into that position almost, you know, to...
Our life has to beat us and beat it into us, you know, and there's so many people that think, well, okay, now I'm learning about codependency, so I'll be all better in a few months, or I'm in recovery from addiction, so I'll be all better in a few months. You're talking, for many of us, about changing behaviors that we've done for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Changing those behaviors is not going to happen overnight. It's just not. It's not going to happen in 1 year or 2 years or maybe even 3, 5, or 7 years. It's going to take a long time of conscious, concerted, pointed effort at learning new behaviors and continuing to change the old ones, because we're always going to want to revert to the behaviors that at one time may have saved our life.
Yep.
And I believe at one time drinking did save my life. It was a form of self-medication.
Yep.
But then the cure turned and started to bite me in the butt. The cure became the disease.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of staying conscious and aware of what we're doing. And the best way to do that is, number one, to be around other healthy people. Number two, I think spending 10 minutes a day writing about how we really feel, how we really feel, are things that can help us stay conscious and aware and in the present moment. See, you can live a day at a time, but you can spend that whole day waiting for tomorrow to come. That's not the point. We're missing the point. Living a day at a time means being present for the moment we're in right now.
Yeah. One of the guests I had on the other week talked about that, and I think a lot of the guests have mentioned that. We talk about following our dreams and what was going on, but he said, you know, I always wanted to start at the finish line. And that, you know, I mean, I want the results, or what I perceive to be the results of freedom and peace, but I really don't want to, you said concerted effort and do that pointed direction all the time. I want, you know, we want maximum results, minimum effort, typically, you know.
Right. We live in a fast food, fast life, way of life country. We want what we want, and we want it now. And we'd rather not pay any dues. Well, good luck.
Yeah, it's a long haul for a lot of us, you know. Let me ask you a question, Melanie. What was going on, like in your heart or in your head, when you even started to search out? How did you recognize codependence, or how did you research it, or what made you drive to that, or how did that all come about in your writing?
Well, I remember I was pregnant with my son, Shane, and I had the nesting influence going on, and so I was fixing the house, and I was painting a room, and all of a sudden I remembered, oh, I always wanted to be a writer. I looked up at the ceiling again, and I said, okay, God, if you want me to be a writer, you're going to have to show me how, because I don't know what to do. Within 24 hours, I had my first job being paid as a writer.
Really?
And, yeah. And I have been writing ever since. Now, that sounds very glamorous, but my first job, I got paid $5 a story.
Right.
But it didn't matter to me. I was doing what I wanted to do. And so I thought of myself as a success from the very beginning.
Right.
I was kind of like on a job training. I didn't go to college, but I did start studying every aspect of writing, and now I forgot the question. Can you?
Well, the question was just what was going on that, you know, how did that all come about? Because I believe, from my minimal research, that codependence wasn't even a word when you started
researching.
No, all right,
let's get back to that. Okay, my dream after I got sober and got out of treatment was to someday be able to help other people get sober, clean and sober too. And so I went to the University of Minnesota chemical dependency counselor training course, and I got my 2 years of sobriety in, and I started looking for a job. And I looked and looked and looked, and finally I found one. And I was so excited my first day, thinking I'd have a caseload of addicts, and I couldn't wait. I show up for work, and they say, okay, you're going to work with the family groups. And it just crushed me. It absolutely devastated me. I didn't want to work with the program was primarily for male clients, so it was women that were in the family group, and I didn't want to work with them. I said, I don't know what to do with these women. And they said, neither do we. That's why you get the job. And the whole aspect of family involvement, that alcoholism and other problems are family affairs, wasn't even recognized back then. And we threw gratuitous groups at the family because we had to do something with them.
Yeah.
And nothing I did worked. And I had also gotten married about 2 years after I got sober. And I married somebody who was, he was in the newspapers all the time. He was a bright, shining recovery star. Well, it took me 7 years to realize that I had married a practicing alcoholic. He kept it from me. He was working in the field at the time. He lied about it. He would disappear for days at a time. It was making me crazy. I was very naive. I thought that anyone that worked in the field would obviously be sober,
right,
and not be lying. And I had all the classic signs of codependency, and it took me a while to realize that the reason I didn't understand these women in family groups was because I didn't understand myself.
Uh-huh.
I didn't understand the caretaking, the controlling, the not listening to myself, the denial. I didn't understand the whole process going on, and nobody was writing about it at the time. You know, I went to every library. I always go to books, and there were no books on it. All the books were about how to help the alcoholic. I was an expert at helping other people. I didn't need to know about that. I needed to know how to help myself.
Yeah.
And by then, I had started writing, and so it went on my goal list. I'm a firm believer in having written goal lists all the time. And it was my goal that if I ever understood what happened to me, because at that point, I didn't even want to go on with life anymore. I mean, I was devastated when I realized my husband was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
I was miserable. I wasn't dealing with my feelings. I wasn't aware of my feelings. I could tell you what he felt, but I didn't know what I felt. I could tell you what he should be doing, but I didn't know what I should be doing. I could tell you what his goals should be, but I didn't have any of my own.
Wow.
And it became a matter, I had another spiritual awakening. Agreed to throw a graduation party for a friend that lived two houses away from me. And she had been nagging me about going to an Al-Anon meeting. And, you know, I thought, I didn't say it, but I thought, you know, you're nuts. I'm not the person with the problem. So anyway, I was going to have her graduation party at my house because her husband was one of those people that constantly was repairing the inside of their house, but never got done in the project. So I had 85 people coming to the house that weekend, and my husband pops home, and he says, well, I've got a chance to go to Vegas. Do you mind? Well, he and I had never once been on a trip. We were broke. He was driving us into the ground financially. Yeah, I minded. But like a good codependent, I said, no, that's fine, honey. Just promise me one thing. And he said, what's that? I said, that you won't drink. Because by then we were at the point where if you drink again, I'm going to leave you.
Yes.
I didn't know yet that his slips were when he stayed sober, not when he got drunk. So he went off to Vegas, and pretty soon I got that feeling in my gut that we get that's telling us something is wrong because something is wrong.
Right.
And I started calling him, and I said, are you drinking? And I heard glug, glug, glug on the other end of the phone, and then he stopped taking my calls. So we get to Saturday. He's supposed to be home, and he's not because he was going to help me get ready for this party for the neighbor. I have 85 people coming the next morning. And at 2 o'clock on Saturday, I started calling him on the phone. I sat there from 2 o'clock that afternoon till 10 o'clock that night, dialing the same number over and over and over again, a number that he wasn't answering.
Right.
Thinking, he's crazy. He's out of control. Something needs to be done about him. And all of a sudden, I lifted up the phone to call the number one more time, and I had my second spiritual awakening. In my first spiritual awakening, I realized that God was real. In my second spiritual awakening, I realized that I was real. For the first time in 7 years, I saw myself. And I thought, you know, he's out of control. What he's doing is crazy. But what I'm doing is a little bit crazy, too. I have 85 people coming tomorrow. I don't have the house clean. I don't have the food made. I don't even have flowers and vases. And I'm sitting here dialing over and over and over and over again a number that's not being answered.
Yeah. Kind of like a prisoner, of our own making, kind of, you know.
Right.
Not even
right. And just so focused on other people.
Yeah.
I never saw myself.
Yeah.
I could never see what I was doing. I could never see what my part was. I didn't know what it meant to take care of myself. I was taking care of everyone. You know, if anyone would have said, take care of yourself, I would have been infuriated because I was taking care of everyone. Mm-hmm. And that was the problem. I wasn't taking care of me. And by taking care of me, I don't mean, you know, coddling myself. I mean, I wasn't being responsible for my own feelings, for my own goals, for reaching my own dreams, and for understanding what I needed to do to be responsible and accountable for my own behaviors. So, and then it was demonstrated that it was a true turning point because the next day, in the middle of the party, I get a phone call, and it's my ex, and he said, I'm at the Twin Cities Airport. Will you come and get me? And for the first time, I said what I really wanted to say, and I think that's one of the hardest things for people with codependency issues to do, is to understand that it's okay to be and express who we are. And I said to him, you know, you got yourself to Vegas. You managed to bounce around town out there for a week. I'm sure if you want to get back home, you can find a way to do that, too. And I hung up the phone.
Good for you.
And that was huge. It was the first
Absolutely.
Boundary I had ever set in my life.
Well.
And it took me a long time, Todd, to understand that, really, boundary setting can be fun, and it's just a matter. See, the thing with codependency is you can have two people doing the exact same behavior, and in one person it's healthy, and in the other person it's dysfunctional, and that's because recovery is an inside job. It's not about what we're doing as much as it is about why we're doing what we're doing.
Right.
Are we doing something out of guilt and obligation? Or are we doing it because we've made a choice to do that and we're willing to take responsibility for the consequences of that behavior?
Okay,
it took me a long time. Just one more. Setting boundaries really can get fun and it can get easy.
Well, that's good
to
know.
So with that, I'll be quiet and give your show back to you.
No, that's fine. You're doing great. I'm having a blast here, and I'm learning a lot of things. Actually, I'm looking at my cat. I think he's going to want to jump up here, and I don't want that to happen. I can control that, I think, a little bit. So I want to tell a story quick, and then we're gonna take a little break. I want to play a song, but, you know, I got to tell myself here, because one of the questions I wanted to ask and I thought about, Melody, is, I mean, do people know they have it, the codependency, and where does it cross the line into being kind of life-changing and negative and splashing up all over everybody else? I mean, you didn't, at that point when you said what you felt, the first boundary ever, I mean, you didn't really know the depths of what was going on, right? I mean, that is a constant seeking.
Didn't have a clue. Didn't even know what the word boundary meant. I had never heard of the word boundary. There's this fine line between having a dream and holding on to it and then the letting go that we need to do. You asked about my writing and how all that came about. Well, as I started to look for answers about what was wrong with me, when I realized it wasn't about the other person, it was about me. First of all, I finally went to a therapy group, and the minute I went in, I had fought going to it, but I went in, and the minute I did, I started crying, which, you know, sometimes it's as simple as feeling the feelings that we're denying we're feeling and letting them go, and we come into balance and we know the next thing to do. But early on, it became a dream of mine to write a book about this, the solution to this problem and what the problem was, because there wasn't anything out about it. And so that went right on my goal list. And I was obsessed. I was just obsessed with codependency. If you sat down with me, I'd start talking about it. I'd point out ways in your life you were doing that. I'd point out ways in my life I was doing that. I started seeing it all around me. I started seeing it rampantly. You know, like these good-looking guys, nice guys, and they'd marry a woman that just screwed them over from day one. And they kept going back for more. I mean, it was just all around me. And I started talking to co-therapists, people that I worked with in the field. You know, what does this mean? What does that mean? What does this mean? And every year, writing that book went on my goal list, and the year would end, and I wouldn't have that book written yet. Uh-huh. And so much in life is about a timing thing. And I never did lose that dream of writing that book. It went on for 5 years. And finally, one day, I knew it was time. I had this huge collection of materials on it. I had talked everyone's ear off about it. I had asked questions and asked questions and asked questions. So I sent out queries to 20 different publishers, and they all turned it down. They all turned this book down. And I didn't have the whole book written. I don't believe in writing a book before it's sold. I wouldn't go in and work all day at a grocery store and hope they'd pay me at the end of the day, and I don't write anything unless I have a contract to write it, except for screenplays. So I queried all these people, and I had a good outline, and they all turned it down. They said, it sounds like a good idea, but we don't think there's that many of them. So when I got the last rejection letter, I packed everything away. I had 2 kids to support. By then I was divorced. And I want to do a little aside here. Dealing with codependency doesn't mean we have to get a divorce. All right? It's not about, you know, who we're with. It's about being with ourselves, be present for ourselves. And in my case, I got a divorce when I realized that my ex-husband, who's now deceased, that his alcoholism was very much impacting the children and impacting the whole energy in the family system in a negative way. And it was just time. I mean, I had worried and fretted so about, are we going to get a divorce? But yet when it was time, I just knew, you know, the grace and the ability and the strength and the power to do it was there. And that's another lesson that I've had to remember, that with much in life, it's a timing thing. And 1 year we can bang our heads against the wall until we're bloody and black and blue and we can't make a thing happen. And the next year, if the time is right, the grace will be there to make it happen. So I put the book away, let go of the idea, and the phone rang about 6 months later, and it was one of the publishers I had queried, and they said, we changed our mind. We want you to write the book right away. And I wrote it, and I looked at it, and I thought, this is just BS. This is just, like, the worst writing I've ever done. And by then, I was working half-time as a writer and half-time in the field. And I was going to throw the manuscript away, and I got a call. The phone rang, and it was a fellow writer. And I said, I can't write this. I don't have anything to say. And the woman said, well, read to me. Read some of it to me. And so I wrote what I had written. And she said, there's nothing wrong with that. Just keep writing and leave yourself alone. Stop picking on yourself. And the publisher literally came to my house and had to wrench the manuscript out of my hands. And I can remember thinking, I'm either totally insane, or this is some of the best writing I've ever done. It's one of the two.
One or the other.
I don't know which one it is.
That's funny. And the story's flowing real nice, because one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, I mean, do you recognize today that people were kind of put in front of you to help you, to make the dream come about, or to mentor you, or, you know, however you want to word that?
You know, I'm going to go back to, I don't think we realize the magic that's going on right now today in our lives when it's taking place.
Yeah.
Because we think it's just ordinary, everyday stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And later we look back and we can see the divine hand in all that we do. We just can't see it at the time. We are literally so close to the forest, we can't, you know, see the trees.
Yeah. That, like the woman that listened to the manuscript, or the person that came to wrench that out of your hand, or the guy that called and said, hey, all of a sudden we want you to write the book. Those things that seem, serendipitous, or we can see how, without all those things all connecting.
And that guy left, the publisher was Hazelton, and that guy left Hazelton right after acquiring my book.
That's wild.
I mean, it was, just very, very magical. And I got a $500 advance for that book. I was scared to death I was going to not be able to write the book and have to pay it back. I mean, I was just horrified. But I went down to the welfare department, and I said, there's no way I can write a book and work full-time at the same time. I've got this contract. If you help me out, I will pay you back. And they agreed to do it. I mean, when the time is right, the doors will open up.
That's the hope shot. That's what I mean. All my guests, it seems like that's another constant theme, is the hope, is that if I'm paying attention and doing my part, or even some of my part, the doors just open up.
Right. And they do, if the timing is right and we're on our path. And I thought the book, I had written a book before that. A lot of people think Codependent No More was my first book. It wasn't. I co-authored a book. It was a true story of another woman who was dealing with schizophrenia. And I worked for 2 years on the book, and I think I made $900.
Mm-hmm.
But the book did win an award for excellence in writing, but I couldn't afford to work at anything that paid $450 a year. It just didn't make the bills.
Yeah.
And I can remember, well, even after Codependent No More started selling, you know, you don't, as a writer, there's a delayed reaction in getting your money. I mean, I was, shortly before I wrote Codependent No More, I was walking down the street thinking, well, I'm just not making enough money, you know. And I looked up at the sky again, like that's where God is when he's inside our hearts, and said, you know, what am I going to do? Should I get a job as a waitress? Should I go back to work in this field? What? But I said, I'm not making any money, enough money to raise the kids as a writer. And then it got really bad. And I remember we were down to like one potato and a can of green beans. And I went to the food shelves. That's where you can go and get canned goods and, you know, shelf products for free for food. And I went there because we were just out of food. We were out of money. It was going to be another week till I got my check. And I was working hard. I didn't get any child support. I didn't get any alimony. And I got to the food shelves, and the sign on the door said, closed, be back Wednesday. And it was Monday. And I just put my head down on the steering wheel, and I sobbed. And it was like I was so tired of being strong. I was so tired of all the work and effort it took to be poor. And it was like I heard a voice. I didn't hear a voice, but it was so clear, and it gave me such peace. And I said, don't worry. Before long, you're never going to have to worry about money again unless you want to.
Yeah, that's it.
And often I want to. Mm-hmm. And I didn't win the lottery, but I did, because when that happened, I was filled with this peace. And I understood that a day at a time, my higher power would take care of my needs financially. And I didn't have to worry. I didn't have to get the big brass ring. You know, it's like, all right, I might not have the food I want, but I've got enough food to feed us for right now, for today. And that's all that matters. Grace is like breathing. I was just talking to someone about that before I talked to you, and the person was upset because they were trying to deal with a problem that they thought was going to happen next week. And I said, well, can you breathe right now for next week? Can you take a whole bunch of breaths and get it done for next week? He said, no. I said, well, that's the way grace works. We don't get grace for tomorrow or next week. We get grace for right now.
That's nice.
That's the only time we can get the guidance and help we need. We can't get it for something that hasn't happened yet.
Let me ask you a question. I want to ask you a question, Melody.
Okay.
Because some of the guests have talked about this during this whole time, and you mentioned when you put your head down that steering wheel. I mean, do you recognize that you were afraid, money, fear? Were there people in your life, were you allowing people to help you, like mentoring you? And were you talking about this with other people, seeking counsel? Or how afraid were you? You know, it must be hard, you know, to work through that. Did you sense any of that stuff? Did you know you were afraid, or isn't that the right word?
Well, I didn't know that I was afraid. I mean, it was just hard. It was hard being a single parent. I wasn't making, you know, that fantastic of an income. I mean, the first 15 years of my sobriety, I spent dirt poor.
Yeah.
I mean, I can feed a family of four on $25 a week. I had gotten quite good at it, but it took a lot of work and it took a lot of energy.
Were you talking to people?
I was talking to people. But there were some, I mean, it's complex, because when I was married to David, he was one of those guys that would write a check whether or not there was money in the bank.
Yeah.
And so there were so many garnishments against him that if I had gone and gotten a regular job, I wouldn't have gotten the paycheck anyway. You know, it would have all gone to someone else. So I had to get creative and find ways to make money where I could actually keep the money and use it, you know, to raise my kids. But I was used to not having a lot of money, but it's a lot. It takes a lot of work, and it takes a lot of energy. And I think the biggest problem then was, so often it goes back to doing the opposite of what we think. I thought I was supposed to be strong and not give in to my feelings, when the opposite was true. I needed to give in to my feelings. I needed to tell myself how I felt. And I was tired, and I was worn out. And one of the biggest things I've seen consistently throughout my sobriety is that when I finally believe I deserve something and ask for it, I usually get it. It's not about life withholding things from me or my higher power withholding things from me. It's me thinking I don't deserve it.
Right, right. It's interesting you said that. Again, you're back to, we talk about everything's the opposite. Not everything, but, you know, it's the opposite of what I think. And you said that. I want to tell you a quick story, only because I asked you the question about, do people know they have this? And when I ordered your book, I think I told you this when I spoke to you earlier last week. When I ordered your book, it came to my doorstep. And I ordered the book, I almost hate to tell you this, Melody, but I ordered it because I see there's so many needy people around me, clingy, needy people. So I got your book, and you know, there's a photograph of the cover right there from where I ordered it. And I read it, said codependent no more. And the book came, and I was on my front porch, and it came in one of those neat cardboard boxes. And I opened it up, and it's all shiny and new, and it said codependent no more. And underneath it, it says, stop controlling other people. And I suppose that was a spiritual awakening for me, because at that point I was busted, like right there, no denying it. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, I didn't really know, and I still probably don't, how that stuff, how deep it runs.
It is, it's insidious. I mean, what's the line between setting a boundary and managing, taking responsibility and managing our own environment and controlling other people?
Yeah.
And I believe all of codependency is about crossing lines, because everything to do with codependency are normal human behaviors.
Right.
Until we cross this line and it becomes dysfunctional. It hurts us. What we're doing hurts us, and maybe hurts other people too. And it's about learning to recognize when we're stepping over a line, when we've lost control, and when what we're doing is hurting other people and ourselves, whether it's controlling, whether it's caretaking, whether it's not being honest about what we're feeling. I mean, feelings are the bane of our existence in recovery. I really believe that. We discovered them in the 70s, and then we didn't know what to do with them. And when we first found them, everyone would have this big, you know, celebration every time they had a feeling, and everyone had to sit down and listen to it. And really, it doesn't need... And then everyone stopped feeling feelings, and they all went on antidepressants because they got tired of dealing with the feelings. And so what does it mean to deal with the feeling, and how important is it, and what role does it play in our lives and our recoveries? Well, it's crucial, and yet they're just feelings.
But aren't feelings the vein of all humans, not just people in recovery or people that are out there or in there or over here? I mean, isn't that a part of a learned environment? Isn't it God-given? I believe we're meant to be dependent on one another to an extent. You talk about those boundaries, those lines. I mean, maybe we're social beings, you know, the social instinct to be dependent upon one another to an extent. Or is that kind of not, how do you see that?
Well, you're talking about two different subjects here. You're talking about interdependency, healthy interdependency, and emotions.
Yeah.
And in any given day, we might have 50 to 100 feelings pass through us. And all we need to do is just feel them and then let the emotional energy go. Just release it to wherever feelings go after they've been felt. But they are important, because if we stop feeling them, we're going to go into denial. We're going to stop listening to ourselves, and we're going to get out of whack, out of balance. And yet they don't need to be this big ordeal. But we can learn a lot about what we want, what we like. It's our key to setting boundaries. You know, what don't we like? What do we like? How does this make us feel? Do we want to be around that? Do we like being in this environment, or does this environment feel horrible? I received a letter from a woman. I personally answer all letters to me on my websites. And I have 3 websites going on. They're service sites. They're all free. And, I mean, this poor woman had been through so much. She had this very hard childhood, and then she married a practicing alcoholic, and then he finally got straight, and they moved in with her mother, who was a practicing alcoholic, and she was working for an abusive doctor. And, I mean, her life just sounded awful, and she couldn't understand what was wrong with her that she didn't like her life. And I said, honey, you know, you've got to give some credibility to your feelings. They're trying to tell you something. I want you to read your letter and then do for yourself what you would tell someone else to do.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I can't tell anyone what they should or shouldn't do. You know, it's all we can do as individuals to figure out what we should be doing. Where do we get off thinking we know what other people should be doing?
Absolutely.
And we can't know another person's heart. What's motivating them, what's not motivating them, where they're coming from. We need to learn to keep our hands in our own pockets. I think another huge mistake that's been made, or misinterpretation of codependency that's been made, is that we shouldn't give to other people. I had this woman write me and say how proud she was of herself. She worked with a social services organization, and she had closed up shop one night, and there was this knock on this door, and it was this woman who had just gotten out of treatment. She didn't have a penny in her pocket. She had no place to go. And the woman said, I was so proud of myself. I wanted to give her $20, but I didn't help her out at all. I just told her closed. I went, oh my God, do people really think that's what I'm saying?
I don't believe that people do. I wouldn't think so, Melody. It's, again, you talked about those boundaries, those lines. How do we first of all realize we need to build them, and then how do we make them and still not have them etched in stone across the board, you know?
Right, because to me, we're not recovering until we can give to other people, and we can be a nurturing, loving human being who can openly care. But the question is, when? You know, when is it appropriate? When is it not appropriate? It goes back to feelings. Is it something we want to do? Feelings and awareness, consciousness. Why am I doing this? Am I doing this out of guilt and obligation? Am I doing this because I want to be doing it?
Right.
I think that some of the fundamentalist recovery groups can teach us that we don't know anything, we can't listen to ourselves, our best thinking will get us in trouble. I don't know that that's necessarily good to downgrade ourselves that way, because so often our higher power speaks through our own heart and what we want to be doing and how a thing feels to us. And it's about motivation. Am I doing this to manipulate someone or because I want to get something back? Or am I giving freely with no strings attached?
Nice. And there you said the word motivation too. You know, through mentorship, and talking to other people, you know, typically they tell us to, look at our motives. But if I don't put air on that with other people, sometimes I'm confused what my motives are, because I still have some of that stuff learned as a kid and learned growing up, the environment, the church. Well, you must, or you shouldn't, or you're expected to, or I'm guilty because, and all that. So sorting all that stuff out, you're my feelings. Am I, for me, we talk about them, you know,
right.
Not with everything.
And life is, life will teach us. Life will bring us what we need. Life is like this magical treatment center that will bring us the exact situations we need to learn what we're supposed to be learning. If we learn to relax into our own lives, stop resisting the things going on, and understand, again, I'm going to say the first thing I said when we went on air, it's about trusting that what's happening today is exactly where we need to be. Now, that might not be very comforting to a lot of people, but it's the truth. Faith is believing that today is okay.
Nice.
No matter how it feels.
Yeah. So, for instance, I'm recognizing that I have some of this codependency, or a lot of it, you know. Typically, my own experience and listening to others is only until there's a discomfort or some sort of other dysfunction going on does it even really get recognized. Then what do I do?
Right, pain. Well, and recovery is not one size fits all. We all want this list of rules. We want this list of rules, and there isn't one. In the beginning, you can have two people doing the same thing, and one is healthy and the other isn't. But life will be like this huge therapeutic community. It will bring us, it will show us what our next step should be if we're actively searching for, looking for it. I'm a firm believer in written goals,
right?
Because it helps us recognize the answer when it does come.
Talk
so many
about
times
that.
The answer's been right there, and we don't see it because we're not looking for it.
Right. Talk about your written goals. What do you practice with that, just roughly for yourself?
It's very easy. Write down everything. no limits. If what you wanted wasn't bad or wrong, what do you want to have, do, get, see, be, meet, obtain, attain, change, let go of? And if you don't have any goals and don't know what you want, then make getting some goals a goal. But write it down. There is so much power in the written word.
That's good advice. Then, that's good information, let me say.
And then put the list away. You don't study it every day. You don't measure to see if you're doing things to accomplish it. Let it go. And live your life by listening to what's in your heart, you know, by asking, you know, our higher power, as we understand God, to show us what his will for us is, and just live your life. And then go back to that list maybe 2 months later or 3 months later or a year later. But we need to, as problems come up in our lives that we can't solve easily, or as we recognize that we want things, add up to the list. Keep that list going, because we're dead when we don't have any more goals. So we might as well be.
Yeah. One of the mentors in my life, he talks about a dream board. You know, it's a little bit different. It's more of a visual thing, you know, but I believe that's, and you know what I found personally for me, I made that a list of sorts like that. And I kind of ran across it like maybe a year and a half or 2 years later. And I found out that the list I made, I sold myself way short, you know, but I made a list like that, you know, but at the time when I made the list, those things seemed huge, those goals. You know, they were.
Right. And, you know, our list should include things we think are possible for us.
Right.
You know, like, I want to win the lottery 10 times and I want to be president. Well, that might not happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, though. The first time I did my goal list, I wrote down what I wanted. I wanted to make $1,300 a month because I thought I could get by a little easier on that. I wrote down very specific goals about what I wanted from my writing career. And I put my list down when I was done. And it's like I heard this voice again, this voice from within that said, okay, now if it wasn't bad or wrong, what do you really want?
Haha.
And so I added an addendum to my list. Everything on that list has come true. Everything. I mean, my list continued to manifest themselves. It's very hard to write down as a specific goals things that we don't really believe in for ourselves, like, you know, winning the lottery or things like that. We find ourselves kind of balking at writing it down. It's much easier to write down our true goals. It's a way of getting in touch with our hearts. A person once said to me that our visions, our dreams of what we want, are God's way of telling us what he wants us to have and to be.
Absolutely. I believe that completely.
Yeah, so to disregard our dreams is to kind of throw God's plan for us out the window. Like you said, sell ourselves short.
You know, a guest that was on the other week, we talked about it. It's from another author. You know, I believe he's deceased, Emmett Fox, but, you know, Our Heart's Desire, you know, and his kind of theory or whatever you want to call it, believe it or not, is, you know, we're never really at peace completely until we're doing the one thing that the higher power, as I understand him, wants me to do. Because I know it deep down, my heart knows it, and it causes me restlessness until I either get the courage, ask for the courage, tap into a power to help me, and then do it, work through the fear, talk to people, and follow my dream.
Yeah. And there are, I believe that there's two kinds of people in life. There are people that have normal, regular dreams. They want a normal, regular job, and they want a family and enough money to pay their bills. And they do something for a living that they're okay with.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people like me that have a thing that they are impassioned about, that they love, that comes before relationships. It's a thing they must do. It's a thing they don't want to be here unless they can do that thing. That thing is what they're here to do. I don't know if I'll ever be married because I'd have to ship my husband out every time I, you know, sent him to write a screenplay or book. It's like, I can hear you breathing two rooms away. Be quiet. And sometimes that can be somewhat of a burden. But overall, I believe it's a gift. And my thing is telling stories. If I can't tell stories, I don't mean lying, telling stories that way. If I can't tell people stories about how things work, how life works, then being here doesn't mean much to me. If I can't be of service to others, then life doesn't feel very good to me.
Now, you recognize that. What about those of us, and I say us, because for a long time, from what I know in my own life, I didn't have any dream. I mean, I must have been in there. I mean, I was asked a number of years ago, Todd, what's your favorite color? And I didn't know. That, I mean, you kind of don't even get to pick your favorite color.
You know, I hate that question. Do you know that right now, the house that I'm in was Oprah featured it in her home decorating magazine, and it's fashioned after a Buddhist temple, and it's painted in red, pink, and orange. People say, oh, red's your favorite color. Not necessarily, but it's the color I like having around me right now. We need all the colors because the color is relative.
Yeah.
And I might go through a period where green and white are my favorite colors, or the colors I need and like around me then. But how can you like just one color? You've got to like all of them. Because it takes all of them to make one.
Leave it up to you. Leave it up to you to spin me around on that. You know, that was an awakening for me only in the sense that I realized that day profoundly that I was empty. I didn't have any goals or any dream, or I wasn't listening
right.
at all.
And life was your therapist. I mean, life will bring us. Life will point things out to us. Life will bring awarenesses to us. And it's okay that if we don't have a favorite color, but your awareness that you didn't even know that much about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And for some of us, the question might be better framed as, what colors do you enjoy wearing? What colors do you think look best on you? I can remember when I first started recovering from codependency, I would just admire women that knew what clothes to buy and how to get their hair done. And so then I would try and get my hair done like they did and dress like they did, and it looked like shit on me. It looked horrible.
Until you found out what you really wanted, what you liked.
Right, until I found out what was right for me.
Right.
And it's the process. Every single question you've asked me tonight, the answer is, it's a process, it's a process, it's a process, it's a process. And we've heard that and heard that, and we're sick of hearing it, but it's true.
Mm-hmm.
Getting clean and sober is a process. Learning about codependency is a process. Changing the behaviors is a process. Learning what colors we look good in is a process. Filling up the emptiness inside is a process. Or letting ourselves, you know, we get to a point where we strive for what they call emptiness, or having nothing going on within, so we can be an empty vessel filled with our higher powers message for us. So those further on down the path seek emptiness, but it's not like that big hole that the wind goes whipping through.
Right.
Not that kind of emptiness, but deliberate spiritual quietness inside.
Well, and again, cool. Growing up, it is cool, but growing up, learned, not learned, taught, or what I perceive to be taught, experienced, you know, and again, a guy like me starting at the finish line all the time, you know, that stuff comes to just really believe and have faith that it's a process. And, you know, that comes with doing it.
Right. And men and pardon me if this sounds sexist, but there is a difference between men and women.
Absolutely.
And there's supposed to be.
Yeah.
But men tend to be all or nothing. Like, if they owe a big bill, they won't pay on it unless they can pay all of it. Whereas a woman will make payments every month.
Mm-hmm.
And understand she's getting towards that goal.
Right.
A man wants to have, if he wants this job or to be this thing, he'll accept no other career except that one thing he wants, whereas a woman will go out and do whatever she needs to do to get to where she wants to go career-wise. But, I mean, I think it's part of the test. I don't know if it comes along with testosterone or what, but men tend to be a little more aggressive in their goal-seeking.
Your observation is probably correct, and you may also be a little bit of a sexist. I don't know.
I could be, but there is a difference between men and women.
Absolutely.
And how we respond to things. Women tend to say, if you ask them what they think about a problem, they'll say, well, I feel like this. Then men will say, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was directed
to read that book. Again, another author, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, and I didn't realize I had that like I did. I got it. Boy, I got a lot of stuff.
I never read that book. Do you know that I was asked to do an endorsement on that book? And I got it when it was in manuscript form, and I thought, oh, this is just nonsense. It's never going to make it. And
some of the things you were talking about are in the book, And you know what? And being a guy like me, we're not always all or nothing, because I only read about half that book. I never finished that either. But I have to learn that stuff because I'm a fix-it kind of guy. You know what I mean? Instead of listening to your feelings as a woman, I just give you the answer.
Well, you want to solve the problem.
How dare I? Yet that's ingrained in me from whatever it was, learned, taught, perceived, survival, whatever that was, that's in me deep. You want to tell me how the fence feels from that's not painted and how you feel about that, and I just want to go paint the fence.
Right, right. And I think the ideal isn't one or the other. It's for each of us to develop a balance.
Right.
I went to a workshop on screenplay writing about a month ago, an all-day workshop. And taking classes like this is kind of like going to therapy groups or some kind of recovery group, in that you might not like everything that happens, but you'll get one piece that you need.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a very uncomfortable day. There were 50 of us crammed into this room where maybe 4 of us should have been. And we were on very hard, tiny, those old-fashioned metal chairs.
Yep.
And we didn't have room to move. And there was one bathroom and 100 people. And a lot of things to complain about. I did, however, get the one piece I needed that day. And that's kind of how life is. If we can, stop complaining long enough to be open to what's going on, we will get that one piece. And one of the things that this man was talking about was about getting the balance in our writing between the emotional and intuitive and creative, and then what we consider the more male attributes, the logic, the rationale, the reasoning, the logical thinking, getting that balance between emotions and intellect, between feelings and problem solving, getting a balance going inside of ourselves. And most of us lean towards one or the other.
Yeah.
The characteristics I describe as feminine or the characteristics I describe as masculine. But again, striving to get that balance. And ironically, there's some very easy things we can do. Now, I don't know, because I don't need to find out what to do to become more emotional and more intuitive. I needed to find out how I can bring logic in. And something as simple as like playing Sudoku, that numbers game, can help us develop our rational, logical side better. Now, for men, maybe listening to music, watching a movie that might be a tearjerker, doing things that are going to bring out the emotional, intuitive side for men is what they need to do to come about and achieve that balance. And I'm not trying to turn men into women or women into men. I'm talking about building these inner attributes or inner tendencies that we have. Because everything we do, we need to practice, you know?
Yeah, it's funny that you put the words rational and logical on the men. I haven't been called that lately.
I haven't funny. Either. Don't feel bad.
It is a balance, you know, and that is, and just even the seeking part, searching, and actually, it's funny how if we give ourselves a chance, or I know just for myself, and listening to you, I believe this as well, that, you know, just they'll want to do it. Where does that come from? Like, all of a sudden, I really want to seek and consider and practice. You know, that's cool. That's grace, mm-hmm. I believe, too. You know, to actually want to do it.
It's fun. Once we get past our fear of these new behaviors, because I think all of us have the one fear. If I get sober, the real me is going to die.
Yeah.
No. It's not. You're just going to kind of flip some of those defects, and you're going to use a positive side of them. And then the practicing of the new behaviors, it really does get fun.
Yeah.
It's so freeing to know that we can say what we have to say, we really want to say.
There's some temper. We have to temper. I have to temper.
Tempered with
words.
Diplomacy.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely. One of the words used to describe me is abrasive. And, you know, I don't want to be abrasive, you know. And I'm learning that, again, through a process of practicing that. But one that I didn't just decide I didn't want to be abrasive. It's kind of a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I learned
that. So few of us know what it means to nurture and be compassionate.
Yeah.
We haven't been trained in these skills, and they need to be learned and practiced. Nurturing is a skill that we can acquire, being a nurturing human being. And so many of us were raised in environments where nurturing was thought of as absolute nonsense, and if we nurtured ourselves or nurtured someone else, we'd spoil them or we'd wreck them, or in sobriety, that person would go out and get high again. Nurturing is a very wonderful, wonderful, fantastic gift, and it can have wild squirrels eating out of your hand, and it can have people literally wrapped around your little finger when we're a nurturing human being, because people crave that.
Yeah.
That part in other people that says, you know what, you're really okay, you know, I care about you, who you are is okay. I'm not going to tell you to be any different. I'm going to tell you that who you are right now is absolutely beautiful and perfect.
That's wonderful, Melody. Melody, you know what? I looked up. We got 5 minutes left. The time goes so fast when I'm doing this. I could listen to you for hours, man. Hours. I really could. Do you want to tell listeners how they get in touch with you? Do you want to mention the websites or whatever you're comfortable doing?
One of my dreams was to have a grief website, a place for people in deep grief that have gone through a crushing blow, lost either money, someone they love died, they lost a relationship, or lost their health. www.melodybeattie.net. Think of it as a safety net.
Okay.
And it's called the Grief Club. It's content heavy, lots of stories there, not from just me, from other people, loaded with stories. Everything from wondering if a person has a particular disease to having a child that's an addict, all kinds of losses.
Okay.
MelodyBeattie.net. My main site is at MelodyBeattie.com, and that has the blog attached to it. And then to go along with my new book, Make Miracles in 40 Days, it's a forum at MelodyBeattie.org, O-R-G. I think of it as organizing our lives. Once we go through identifying all these problems and getting better, then we learn to connect with our inherent power.